The Musicians of Bremen, and Constant Lambert's Mr. Bear Squash You All Flat. Two performances will be given at 2 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Ticket information at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Once again, this hour of the show, we'll bring you a program from the Focus 580 archives. This is the show originally broadcast in July on the 25th. So as you listen, do keep in mind that this morning and this hour, we will not be taking your calls. It was a little over a year ago that the Gulf Coast of the United States was devastated by one of the deadliest hurricanes in U.S. history, Hurricane Katrina. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a hurricane researcher. His name is Ivar van Heerden, and he says that this was a preventable disaster. It was not a natural disaster. Almost all of the problems associated with Katrina were due to the action or perhaps the inaction of human beings. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about Katrina and what went wrong and also what would happen if another storm like Katrina or bigger, and certainly that's not impossible, would hit the same area. It is something that he goes into in his recently published book, which is entitled The Storm. The subtitle is What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina, the inside story from one Louisiana scientist. This book is published by Viking. Let me just tell you a little bit about our guest, Ivar van Heerden. He's the co-founder and deputy director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. He's also director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes and is also associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU. He has Ph.D. in marine sciences from LSU, where his research focused on the Atchafalaya River Delta. Also has been doing research on disaster preparation and response, on coastal geomorphology, environmental management, habitat restoration. He makes his home near Baton Rouge. As I said, was one of the people who has who emerged right after the storm and continues to be one of the most vocal critics of the government's failure to respond to the storm and its aftermath. Dr. van Heerden, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for the invite.
The book goes into some detail talking about the storm, how it formed, and how it was tracked. And if people want to go to that detail, they certainly can. The bottom line is here, though, that the storm was initially, as this works, was identified. It was started out as a tropical depression. It became stronger. It got a name. It became stronger and stronger. And at some point, it seemed very likely that it was going to make landfall, as it did, somewhere in the Gulf Coast. I guess the question here is, how many days before landfall could it be said with a high level of probability that this was a very serious storm, that it was going to hit the coast of the United States, and that we should expect very serious consequences?
Well, at least 3 days out, we knew it was going to be a major hurricane and it was going to hit somewhere in the central part of the Gulf Coast. About 35 hours from landfall, we knew that if it stayed on the projected track that the National Hurricane Center had come up with, that it was going to flood New Orleans. So we had about 35 hours of warning that we were going to flood large parts of the city.
Was it possible, though, to say even before that, maybe that you would not have been able to say, we think that the probability is very high that it's going to affect New Orleans and flood large portions of the city, but perhaps even a few days further out would have been possible to say, we think that the probability is high enough so that right now we need to be doing some things. I mean, before the point where we were really right up against it, so you were talking about not more than a couple of days. Was there a time earlier on when you might have said if government officials had been paying closer attention, they would have had even more time to do whatever could be done?
Well, the you know, everybody is led to a certain extent by the National Hurricane Center track predictions and the cone of uncertainty that goes with that. Mm-hmm. And it was only early Saturday morning that track was changed to indicate that it was going to impact close to Greater New Orleans. So, you know, at best, there was at least, 48 hours, maybe even as much as 50 hours of pre-warning that it was going to hit New Orleans.
So at that point, what happened? Who, and particularly when it seemed to be fairly certain that it was going to happen, that it was going to hit New Orleans or it was going to hit very close, you expected the consequences would be serious. At that point, what was done? In what way did the government, the state government, the federal government respond? What was the initial response?
Well, you know, the first response was, that the state of Louisiana declared a state of emergency for a number of the coastal counties or parishes, as we call them. And then this sets the stage for the state to get involved in helping to get resources in the field and also the trigger to start evacuations. On the Saturday. On the Sunday, the federal government, President Bush, declared a state of national emergency and backdated it a day. So before landfall, we had done all the legal things in terms of declaring states of emergency. When the president declares a state of national emergency, that triggers FEMA and all the federal agencies to then get involved in the activities. And what should have happened right away should have been the recognition that we have, you know, all these folk in New Orleans who don't have motor vehicles, and they wouldn't be able to get out as well as the disabled and sickly. So we should really have started Saturday morning trying to get these folk out.
Mm. Would this, assume the best here. In fact, would that have been, given the number of people that you're talking about who would have needed help, who couldn't get out by themselves, would that actually have been possible? Could an evacuation like that have been achieved?
At that time, no, because nobody had really looked at what was needed. We had had a planning exercise a year before Katrina, known as the Hurricane Pam exercise, where this was funded by FEMA, and there were a lot of agency folk there, a lot of local officials. And the point that came up was, how are we going to deal with these evacuees? And it was decided that that would be looked at in the following year at another exercise. So we really didn't have a plan. From our perspective at the university, we had looked at the potential of using all the buses in New Orleans and had concluded, this was a number of years ago, that there weren't enough buses in New Orleans to get everybody out. So the unfortunate thing was nobody had really looked at the needs of those who most depended on government to get out of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. I think that it is true to say that scientists had been concerned about what would happen if a hurricane this strong should hit New Orleans, that people had been voicing their concern for years. And certainly, as you say, a year before, in 2004, there was this exercise to look at what might happen and what the response would be and what the needs would be, this exercise called Hurricane Pam. And even at that time, and I believe that you were involved in that, there were people who were pointing out that we could have a serious problem, that if the storm like this hit, what did happen would happen, and that it was something that had to be prepared for. And I guess the question is that why so many people are asking is, why is it that, given that so many scientists had essentially predicted what ended up happening, why it was that we were so poorly prepared to deal with the effects of a storm like this?
Well, unfortunately, the science went unheeded, and especially in the last 4 or 5 years where, you know, from my sense that we had actually been looking at the specifics of New Orleans. So we had a wealth of information. We knew the numbers, who would leave, who wouldn't, where they would be, those who wouldn't leave, and so on. We'd even gone to the point of mapping every single pipeline in New Orleans, where all the gas storage tanks were, and so on. So we had this wealth of information, but the problem was we could never get government, and especially the federal government and FEMA, to pay heed to the science. And so as a consequence, I think all of us suffered.
Why do you think that was? And did that have something to do with the issue of not enough resources going into disaster prep generally? Was it that there was so much of a concern about terrorism and dealing with that? Did it have something to do with the fact that just people, the federal government wasn't that much interested in Louisiana because it was Louisiana? I mean, one has to ask the question, and maybe it's somehow a little bit of all of those things, why it is that, well, on the one hand, scientists were saying, look, we have a serious potential problem here, why it was that the government, particularly the federal government, didn't seem very interested.
Well, you know, that's a good question, and there are a number of layers. If you will, the upper layer is the revamping of FEMA and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. And so as a consequence, FEMA lost a lot of its clout, if you will, and it became a subpart of a much bigger organization. It lost funding. There seems to have been a effort to put a lot of political appointees in senior positions, and the FEMA of old, the FEMA that, for instance, responded to the bombings of the World Trade Center, was an organization that had professionals running most of the of its departments and its section chiefs. So we lost a lot of those professionals who left the business. So overall, with the occupation, with the focus on terrorism and less focus on natural disasters, FEMA in many ways became weakened. The other problem that we encountered as scientists, and this is especially true of the Hurricane Pam exercise, a lot of the emergency management people who were in FEMA are ex-military folk, and they're very used to taking orders and doing things top-down. And so I think they found it difficult or culturally almost unacceptable to be taking information and taking notice of these geeks at universities who were pushing a lot of science. And so, you know, there are many different levels where this seems to have broken down, and as a consequence, the science never made its way up the system.
We have a caller. I'd want to bring them right in, and perhaps for anybody who has just tuned in, I should also reintroduce our guest, Ivar van Heerden. He is the co-founder and deputy director of the LSU, Louisiana State University Hurricane Center, and he's also director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes. In addition, he is associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at LSU and is author of the book The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina, published by Viking. He's talking with us by telephone. Questions are welcome. We have one person here ready to go. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we have someone on that line, someone who is listening in Indiana, and we'll talk with them here on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Essentially, I guess you've answered the question I had David ask you about at the beginning of this last talk you went into. I remember sitting back, and when I heard, I think it was on NPR, but anyway, that the man that was head of FEMA, is the highest level he ever reached in any kind of thing, was judging horses. And I almost fell out of my chair. I'm not exactly a lover of the Bush people for sure, and that just nailed the the nail into the coffin to me that it's too bad these things happen, but they happen. My question, I guess, will stretch a little further is, did you ever come across any bureaucratic people or anybody in the government, state, county, whatever, who said, well, how in the hell you know it's going to be here in 3 days? Did they question your computer models? Anything like that, a little more sophisticated than just, political hacking around. I wonder if that occurred, and if so, what is being done to correct that? Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for the question. No, the National Hurricane Center does the actual predictions of the track and the intensity. And what we do at LSU is we have a model that predicts the surge. It's a little experimental model, but we've been doing this for a number of years, and the model has proved to be very, very accurate. So we supply that data to the state, and it's given to the State Emergency Operations Center, and it's also emailed all over the country, all different agencies, to the media, and many media pick it up. So there's no, I don't think anybody was questioning whether the storm was going to hit or when and the surge. I think everybody understood that, certainly at the state level, because we have a very good working relationship. I think where this thing broke down was, especially at the federal government level, and to some extent the lack of communication, the failure of communications would have, all through the system would have exacerbated it. But I don't think the senior federal employees fully appreciate how serious this was and the consequences. And, of course, once the levees went, then we had this major, major catastrophe. But unfortunately, the word about the levees failing was never made public for 24 hours. And that set back everything by 24 hours. So a number of issues compounded this. And then, of course, we didn't see any serious flights of helicopters until the Saturday morning, the landfall being on Monday. So it was that failure, I think, of senior officials to appreciate how serious this was that led to a lot of the tragedy.
I certainly wouldn't want to take anything away from your commentary on the failure of the federal government here. It seemed to me that there also were failures on the level of the local government in New Orleans and of the state government in Louisiana, and that the part of the problem seemed to be very tangled lines of authority, people being not really sure who was supposed to be in charge, people, various units of government or levels of government somehow waiting for somebody else to do something, elements of government not wanting to cede authority to anybody else, that it seemed that it's a very complicated tangle of things. And while one might say that, yes, it was a serious failure on the level of the federal government, that there was serious failure at all levels of government.
I certainly would agree with that. Unfortunately, this, it's almost a case of in the fog of war, you have these problems. And because communications collapsed so severely, a lot of folk weren't too sure what they were supposed to be doing. The bottom line for most emergency managers in Louisiana was that based on the Hurricane Pam exercise, they believed a large part of the failure still is the fact that the levees, the last levee had failed by about 10 o'clock on Monday morning, and it was noon the next day before the word got out about the breaches, and at that time only one breach. So we unfortunately lost 24 hours where we could have been bringing, some real resources into New Orleans. But be that as it may, certainly within the city, the National Guard, the Coast Guard especially, and local police and others, started boat rescues and helicopter rescues at about 3 o'clock on the Monday afternoon.
It sounds as if part of the problem was that after the hurricane made landfall, that the people were really anticipating and were fearful of what would happen as a result of the hurricane coming ashore. And when the hit had been weathered fairly well, that perhaps a lot of people breathed this great sigh of relief and said something like, wow, we really dodged the bullet that time, and were not then continued to be on guard for what might happen as a consequence afterwards, because the serious problems did come indeed from the levee breaches and the flooding that resulted, not from the initial force or whatever damaging properties the hurricane had when it made landfall. At least I don't believe that was the case in New Orleans. It may have been different on the Mississippi coast.
Yes, I mean, if the levees hadn't failed for Louisiana, we wouldn't be really talking about Katrina, but obviously Mississippi would still have been as badly damaged. But the fact that it took a while to get the word out meant that we didn't get resources down there. And certainly national media, NPR was one of them, were saying on the Monday morning early, we've dodged the bullet. You know, mm-hmm. On the evening, I was at the State Emergency Operations Center, and everybody thought the same thing, that we had dodged the bullet. So the fact that that we didn't get the news that the levees had failed for 24 hours, I think, plays into the whole response effort.
So why is it that happened? There was that delay in getting information that there had been the levee breach and that this flooding had begun and it was proceeding very rapidly.
I really don't know. NPR did a very detailed assessment, and apparently, you know, the New Orleans mayor's office, FEMA, Department of Homeland Security, they all knew by late on Monday afternoon, and the White House was informed before midnight on the Monday, but somehow or other that never got out into the public domain until we started to see the footage from the TV helicopters. Some of that, I think, reflects that for instance, the New Orleans Levee Board that was monitoring the levees, their offices got totally flooded. They didn't have telephones or cell phones. Part of it is the Corps of Engineers in New Orleans went out on Monday afternoon to try and inspect the levees, but they couldn't get to them. They saw flooding. Perhaps they didn't appreciate how serious it was. But the first person to make it public was actually the chancellor of Tulane University. Hmm.
This was a very big storm. It was, I believe, the sixth strongest Atlantic hurricane ever recorded. It was the third strongest that made landfall. So I suppose some people might say that the likelihood of another storm like this coming along anytime soon should be, the probability should be low. At the same time, I would think you would agree that not only, you know, it is possible, and in fact, it is possible that an even bigger storm could hit the same area. Is it possible actually to attach some sort of probability to a question like that?
Well, the statistic that we put forward from the LSU Hurricane Center is to point out that since 1950, we've had 9 major hurricanes hit coastal Louisiana. That's Category 3 and above. Any one of those storms, while it was still out in the Gulf, had changed its course by 1 to 2 degrees, would have flooded New Orleans. So if we think about southeast Louisiana, because the area that's super susceptible to surges is not just New Orleans, it's the whole of southeast Louisiana. Those areas have the potential of going under about once every 7 years. The situation gets worse and worse and worse as we lose more and more wetland. Now, Katrina was a fast-moving Category 3 storm. It was a large storm in terms of its area, but when it made landfall, it was a fast-moving Category 3 with winds of about 117 miles an hour. If Katrina, and it missed New Orleans, by more than 30 miles, if it had come, made landfall and gone west of the city, instead of going east of the city, going west of the city, and maybe slowed down just a little, it would have totally flooded every part of New Orleans. All the areas that flooded during Katrina, plus the areas that didn't, as well as that part of New Orleans that's south of the river, what's known as the West Bank. So we would have seen a far greater catastrophe, and that flooding would have, wouldn't have required the levees to breach. It would have been all reflected water coming over the levees. So New Orleans is super susceptible to these surges. You know, we're facing potentially another active season. We're in this period of 10 to 15 years of a lot of activity, and then there's the question of global warming. So, you know, the odds don't look very good right now.
We are just a bit past our midpoint. We have callers we will get to. Let me again introduce the guests. Ivar van Heerden. He is Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Louisiana State University. He is also the co-founder and deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center and director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes. He is the author of the book, The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina, the inside story from one Louisiana scientist. That's the subtitle. It's published by Viking. It's out in bookstores now, and we are open to questions from people who are listening. And we're just going to pause here in this moment and for a moment in this morning's archive presentation of Focus 580 to bring you some weather information. A little earlier this morning, the National Weather Service in Romeoville issued a flash flood warning for southern Ford County in east central Illinois. That includes the city of Gibson City. That will be in effect until 12:15 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Earlier this morning, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated flash flooding was likely occurring from thunderstorms and other heavy showers over the warned area. Locations in the warning include, but are not limited to, Sibley, Roberts, and Melvin. Again, this is a flash flood warning for southern Ford County in east central Illinois that will be in effect until 12:15 this afternoon. We'll have more on the weather coming up for you as part of the afternoon magazine that gets underway at noon. Now we'll continue this conversation with Ivar van Heerden. This is a program from the Focus 580 archives. We first broadcast the show July 25th. Remember, this morning we're not taking calls. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. History-wise, has the neglect toward impending disaster, you know, tornadoes hit so quickly there's not much preparation, just get underground. But with these hurricanes, has it been, I'm thinking of Galveston, Texas, it was hit. You know, they didn't have much warning then. But Katrina, there was some weeks, were there not, and the neglect, you know, and they paid the price. Could you address that question?
Yes, certainly. Katrina, you know, was born just to the east of the Florida Keys and actually crossed the Keys as a Category 1 storm. It then got into the Gulf of Mexico. There was some uncertainty initially where it was going to go. The initial forecast had it going into the Florida Peninsula. But, you know, at least 48 hours out, we then knew that it was going to hit New Orleans. So, you know, in terms of Katrina, there wasn't, you know, more than say, 50 hours of warning that it was going to hit the city. You know, unfortunately, it did. The only thing we know in terms of weeks is come June 1, we're in hurricane season, and all the way through to officially the end of November. Now we believe through to the end of December we could get a big storm.
Yes. Well, I was curious about the neglectful. It was born way out in the ocean, was it not? And they knew it was out there. And as it began to build, I know by the time it gets to the Gulf, it's too late. Somebody's going to get it. But the timing for the preparation to evacuate people and to do the best they could with that sort of thing, then the notice, that's what really plagued me about the events there, that they just sat around and they knew it was coming and there was no, unless you had an automobile, then the roads were so clogged that they couldn't very well. And it just seemed to be the total incompetence on the part of the local, the federal government, you know, that, and where were the poor in the Ninth Ward going to go? You know, they had to walk if they got anywhere. So it just seems to me that the whole thing was just made to order with this current administration, who, you know, you don't worry about anything till it happens, and then you don't worry then. So it just struck me as being something that a lot of advance warning people could have been begun to be moved, and especially those the most immobile, and to places where they would be safe. But anyway, that's my take on it, and thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, just to be clear here now, I guess it's my understanding that the tropical depression that eventually became Hurricane Katrina formed on August 23rd, and it made its landfall in the Gulf Coast on August 29th. So we're really now only talking about 5-6 days, even from the initial point of it just becoming a tropical depression. And there's no guarantee that a tropical depression would go on to become a hurricane. So it wasn't. Well, I'm not sure maybe it was the next day. Maybe it was the 24th. It actually became a named storm. So there you're only talking about 5 days from being a named storm to landfall in the Gulf. And even within that period, there being some uncertainty about where it would make landfall and at what level of intensity.
Yeah, no, that's all perfectly true. And, you know, one of the things that has to figure into this is evacuations cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. So governments and industry do not want to have to evacuate unnecessarily. So there's this tendency to try and wait, if you will, to the last minute. Certainly, once the National Hurricane Center had the track onto Louisiana, I think everybody started to take notice. Unfortunately, there is that group of folk, and our initial surveys had said that more than 20% of the folk in New Orleans wouldn't evacuate, and that a fair portion of those just wouldn't do it because they just don't evacuate, they don't see the point in doing it. So you've always got that hard-headed individual who won't evacuate that you have to deal with afterwards.
So again, tell me that you there were a certain percentage you knew that wouldn't. How many of those are people that, for one reason or another, actually couldn't, and how many of those people who had some means to leave, but they decided themselves that they were not going to leave?
Well, based on our public opinion surveys before Katrina, 68% of the folk would have left. So that would have meant that we would have had over 300,000 people left behind, and about 127,000 of those would have been residents who didn't own motor vehicles. What we now know is that the evacuation was very successful. We used this contraflow where you flow traffic out on both sides of the interstate, and it looks like we got probably 80 to 85% of the population out. So some of those original diehards, when we did the survey, I think when they saw the maps in the local newspaper on the Sunday morning showing the city was going to flood, probably then decided it was time to get out. But the unfortunate thing is the 127,000 who don't own motor vehicles, and a lot of those are elderly, disabled, and infirm.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else, and this is someone on a cell phone in Wyoming, Illinois, on line number one. Hello. Is the caller there? Yes.
I appreciate your discussion on the responsibilities and the breakdown in communication. I had a question specifically about the case of the resident of a nursing home that died in the... It's more of a question, I guess, but it's if I follow in the paper, the medical personnel are being charged with murder. It's very strange because it seems to me that the local authorities share some of the responsibility. Secondly, the medical who left and didn't stay by their post are not being charged. The ones that stayed 4 or 5 days and were rescued or relieved are being charged. Do you have any comments on this sort of?
Yeah, we lost a little bit of your caller there on and off, but I think enough to get the point of the question. And I don't know, Dr. Van Heerden, if that's something that you have thought about or you have any comment on?
I don't have any information that's been undertaken by the State Attorney General's office. And, I know about as much as the average person, and that's just from reading the newspapers. The only thing that I could add is that in these hospitals, because I had friends who were involved from the medical side and the emergency management side, you know, things were pretty tense because they ran out of power, and without power they couldn't air condition, they couldn't run some of the life support systems. So they had a pretty tough situation until they were evacuated.
Hmm. I don't know if that's is the caller still there?
Yes.
That's
fine. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's then go on to someone else. This is Danville, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, I have a question about the breaches of the levees. From what I understand, the levees were always kind of under-designed for a maximum storm. And initially, after they failed, the original talk was that they were overtopped. And then later on, it seemed to come out that maybe there was some design or construction failures. I just wonder if that's been they've come to a conclusion on that. And also, what's the capability of the levees now that they've been working on them? Are they, what kind of storm can they sustain?
Yeah, good question. I covered quite a bit of that in my book. 169 miles of the 350 miles of levees around Greater New Orleans failed one way or another. The large majority of them failed because of design problems. The designs didn't take into account the soils, the very, very weak soils. In addition, the Corps of Engineers used what they call standard project hurricane. This was a design parameter in terms of a storm. And unfortunately, that design parameter had been upgraded a number of times, but they used a 1958 definition, which meant they were designing for a weaker storm. And in addition, we now understand that even though the Corps of Engineers recognized that this is an area that subsides, they didn't build the fact that the levees would subside into their walls. And in addition, they used an old survey mark. So they ended up making the levees, in some cases, 1.5, other cases, 2 feet too low. So a combination of errors that led to the failure of the levee system.
And what condition are they in now? I know they've been trying to rebuild it. Are they? What are they capable of sustaining?
Well, the repairs are very robust, but the problem is we still have the same level of protection that we had pre-Katrina, and what that level of protection is only for a Category 2 storm. So New Orleans, unfortunately, is as susceptible now to flooding as it was pre-Katrina. The levee section that failed the worst in terms of length, and that's along the Mississippi River Gulf outlet, has been totally rebuilt. But again, it's still an earthen levee. It doesn't have grass on it at the moment, and it is unprotected. It doesn't have any armoring on it. So if we got another Katrina, we'd suspect large sections of that levee would fail once again.
Does that, Colonel, does that get at your question?
Yeah, yeah, I appreciate that. I work as a geologist, and I always find a lot of engineered barriers are asked to do a lot more than they're capable of doing. I'm from St. Louis area, actually, and just the levees they're building down there, I just think you're just kind of building yourself an eventual failure, no matter how you construct it. So just a little comment on the side. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I think that is the case, Dr. Van Heerden, that the big concern before was not so much that you would have all these widespread levee failures and that you would end up with flooding, but that water would come in, essentially would be driven in from the Gulf into Lake Pontchartrain, and then that would overflow into the city. And that some people have said that what you need to do is construct some kind of barrier, some way of closing off the lake from the Gulf, kind of like you have in the Netherlands, for example. Is that something that you think is something that should be done? Is anybody thinking seriously about something like that?
Well, it's definitely something that needs to be done. And in fact, in the book, I devote a chapter to the future and what we could be doing. If one's ever had the chance to look at the Netherlands system, then you realize that we can build what's required to save coastal Louisiana. And part of it is floodgates and barriers. We need to look at, for example, Lake Pontchartrain and put a floodgate barrier across the lake to stop the surge from entering it. There's some areas where man-made navigation canals go right into the city, and in this way we inject the surge into the city. Those canals need to be sealed with gates, and we really need to rebuild the levee system and be a lot smarter as well. But tied to all of this, one of the key, absolute key things is we've got to restore our coastal wetlands and we've got to restore our barrier islands, and both of those are very doable. So if we could come up with a plan, and there is one in the book, it's meant to start the debate, if you will, where we rebuild our wetlands, and if we think about the protection as we have robust armored levees to protect the infrastructure, we then rebuild the levees, and the levees then protect, we rebuild the wetlands by getting sediment out of the Mississippi and Atchafalaya rivers, and those wetlands then protect the levees, and then we rebuild our barrier islands just as we restore beaches in many parts of the country by getting sand from offshore. Those barrier islands protect the wetlands protect the levees, and the levees protect our homes. So all of that's doable. We've just got to get the powers to be to move on it.
I do believe that it's true that if you look over the time, say from the time that the city of New Orleans was founded to the present, that I think we're talking about on the order of millions of acres of coastal wetland has been lost. If that had been there, if those coastal wetlands and barrier islands had been there, what had been there before, if they had been there, that you believe that would have made a big difference in the impact of Katrina?
Oh, it would have made a huge difference. For all of Louisiana, we've lost about 1 million acres in the last 70 years. In terms of protection for the greater New Orleans area, we've lost almost 500,000 acres. We now know from some very recent research that if you have healthy wetlands, for every 3 to 4 miles of healthy wetlands, you can knock the surge down by a foot. So if we could rebuild those 500,000 acres that used to protect New Orleans, in some cases we could knock down the surge by 6 foot. Reducing the surge by 6 foot during Katrina would have meant no flooding, no levee breaches. Hmm.
To do what you're talking about with the kind of coastal restoration and also perhaps constructing physical barriers, the one that would close off Lake Pontchartrain from the Gulf, from any surge that would come in from the Gulf, and the others, and with the navigation canals that you talked about. Has somebody put a figure on this? How much would it cost to do all of this?
Well, you know, there are a number of figures around. I tried to sit down with some construction engineers as well as, you know, benefiting from spending a week with the Dutch engineers looking at their systems. And we're looking at a probably $30 billion to redo this. Now, it sounds like a lot of money, but one has to recognize that Katrina, when it's all over, is going to be about a $300 billion disaster. So for a tenth of what it's costing us to try and get New Orleans and coastal Louisiana sorted out, we could build all of these systems. The key to this is that it can be done. We've got the Mississippi River, we've got the Chaffalai River, we've just got to mimic the natural system, and we can do it. But as we move forward, as global warming takes more hold, New Orleans is just going to be the first of many, many cities that's going to have to deal with flooding problems. So the technologies, the engineering experience that we gain in doing this would be transferable throughout the, you know, the coastal parts of our country and certainly overseas. So, you know, this is not just Louisiana's problem. It's actually the nation's problem, because we're the source of so much oil and gas, major ports, chemical facilities, and so on. But also, we're just the first in line.
I'm sure that there are people who would make the argument that there's no question that there would be, should be, must be a city at the mouth of what is the most significant navigation channel in the United States, the Mississippi River. On the other hand, they would say, though, that the location is very vulnerable to storm damage, and because it is so low, it doesn't make sense, it really didn't make sense to have the kind of spreading out of people, particularly in very low areas that we had there. And then perhaps there's some question about what the New Orleans, the city of the future, is going to be. Can it be built, rebuilt the way it was? Should it be rebuilt the way it was? And I wonder what your thought about that is, and particularly about the issue of rebuilding, and whether it would make sense to have perhaps a different kind of a city.
Well, I think we definitely have to look at a different kind of a city, especially for some areas. And the number one thing is to do what our forefathers did, and that's to build homes on stilts. In the old days, they built a home on brick legs or wooden legs, and every so often they'd come and jack the house up just to raise it enough so it wouldn't flood. So, yeah, that's the first thing. We need to be a lot smarter about how we build our homes. But at the same time, New Orleans cannot grow be any bigger than it is right now. The levees totally confine the growth. And we also can't move New Orleans anywhere, because it would be just too far away from the main infrastructure. However, if you recognize in the Netherlands, you know, they have huge areas that are more than 20 feet below sea level. We don't even have that problem in New Orleans. So if we can take some of their technology, if we can be a lot smarter about what we do, if we can unleash the Mississippi River, then I firmly believe that we can totally rebuild the city, albeit a different city.
One thing that I know I have read about you, and I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but apparently because you were so outspoken about governmental failures in dealing with Katrina and afterwards, that you got some static from other people there at LSU who felt that you were potentially causing problems for the university with its relationship with the government. And, of course, that's very important to big universities because they're dependent on grant money. And I think that there were some people who wish that maybe you hadn't been quite as outspoken as you have been. And you seem to be a guy who was determined to say what was on your mind no matter what. Has there been any long-term consequences for you of the fact that indeed you did stand up and you're continuing to stand up and say, look, I think that there are significant problems here and that they need to be addressed?
Yeah, well, the, what I was told was my talking to the media was hurting the university's chances to get federal research dollars in the future, which I personally didn't buy. The bottom line is that upper administration has been kind of wrapped over the knuckles, so to speak. There have been a number of newspapers that have written editorials condemning what they've done. And in addition, a large number of LSU professors signed a letter condemning the university for trying what seemed to be an attempt to muzzle me. Right now, you know, things are fine. you know, I continue to do what we're doing. The important thing is every single statement we've made, we could back up with science. And so, you know, we weren't just flying off the cuff, so to speak. It was sometimes very difficult because of the amount of information we had to not be too outspoken. But I think, you know, certainly all our research has proved true, and our initial work on the levees has been borne out even by the Corps of Engineers. So, as far as I'm concerned, it's an issue that's dead, and that was just an unfortunate part of what happened during Katrina.
Well, we're going to
thank you very much.
Our guest, Ivar van Heerden, he is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Louisiana State University. He is also the co-founder and deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center and director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes. He is the author of the book, The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina, the inside story from one Louisiana scientist. It is published by Viking. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast the show July 25th. The program today made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She'll join us at 1:06 Central Time. It's 1 minute before noon Central Time. Let's take a look at commodity prices. Kansas September wheat, 472.5, up 2.5. In Chicago, September wheat trading at 408, up 6.75. December 425, up 5.5. September corn, 229.5, down 1/2. December corn, 245.5, down 1/4. March, 260, down 1/2. December, 07, 293.75, down 2.5.